Draw nigh and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Schoen. We're here today in the matter of Edwards versus Nicholson, docket number 053546. Counsel for each party, note your appearance for the record.
Your Honor, Robert McCarter for Ms. Edwards.
Thank you.
Your Honor, Rebecca Baer with Brian Ripple.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their argument. Mr. McCarter, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes.
You have it. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert McCarter for Ms. Shirley Edwards. We're here today on two questions before the court. First is whether the board erred in finding that Ms. Edwards' May 2000 submissions, there were three of them, did not qualify as a request for waiver of indebtedness under 38 U.S.C. section 5302A. The second is whether the board erred in presuming the mailing of the statutorily required notice of indebtedness relating to a second debt of roughly $12,000. I'm going to start with the first asserted indebtedness of approximately $2,000, and I want to get right to the question that the court asked us to address in order, and that's the standard of review that applies to the sufficiency of a request for waiver under Section 5302. And it's our position that Ms. Edwards' submission was legally sufficient to constitute a request for waiver of indebtedness is a legal question that should be reviewed de novo. Now, that legal question will turn on underlying facts, and those underlying facts will be subject to the clearly erroneous standard of review. In support of our submission that the proper standard of review for the legal sufficiency of a request for waiver is de novo, we cite the court to U.S. v. Oakley 744 F. 2nd 1553. That's a 1984 decision from the 11th Circuit dealing with an overpayment, a debt related to an educational loan, and whether the request there was sufficient to constitute a request for waiver. Another case that doesn't deal in this precise context but is similar is the Bricklayers case out of the 5th Circuit, 512 F. 2nd 1017. That dealt with the legal sufficiency of documents relating to whether those documents were sufficient to establish a union health and welfare fund. Now, the way we submit the board should have analyzed this issue was to look and see whether the requirements set forth in the notification letter were met, the requirements for establishing a waiver. The board's findings in this case on this issue were that Ms. Edwards' submissions did not constitute a request for waiver because they did not use the word waiver or synonyms for the word waiver. And those are factual findings to which the court would defer. By that I mean that the board's finding that the word waiver did not appear in her submissions or that there was no synonym, those would be subject to clearly erroneous. But our point is that that does not end the inquiry because the notification letter that was provided to Ms. Edwards didn't purport to require those words at all. Rather, in the notification letter is Appendix A to our opening brief. The parties inadvertently left that page out of the record, but I think everybody agrees that that's the right language. And in the paragraph on that relating to waivers, it's the fourth paragraph that says the right to request waiver of the debt. And in there it tells the claimant exactly what they have to do to request a waiver of the debt. And there's a few requirements there. One is that the claimant has to submit the request within 180 days. The second is that the request has to be submitted in writing. And third, and this one's a little lengthy, the claimant has to explain any responsibility they have had in causing the debt or why they were not responsible for it, any undue financial hardship which would be caused by collection of the debt, and any other circumstances that would make collection inequitable. And finally, they note in this letter that's provided to the claimant, this is the statutorily required notice, that if the claimant is claiming financial hardship, they have to complete and return an enclosed financial hardship form. Where the board went wrong, we submit, is the board did not look at all to see whether these various factors were satisfied. Instead, the board focused on whether the word waiver or a synonym appeared in Ms. Edwards' submissions.
Counsel, if I may interrupt. It seems to me that some of the statements in Ms. Edwards' letters to VA could also be construed as a request for a determination as to the accuracy or validity of the debt. Was she also seeking that action?
She was also seeking that action. I would construe both her as seeking an adjustment of the debt based on her prescription drugs, the notion that this insurance payment that led to the overpayment was a one-time payment. But she also did request that her benefits get reinstated retroactively, effective the date they were terminated, which could only happen if the debt was wiped out entirely.
So the same documents could serve two purposes.
Yes. Yes, that's our position, Your Honor. And the...
Explain to me again why that could only happen if her debt was wiped out due to a waiver as opposed to wiped out because it was erroneously computed.
Well, it would have to have been erroneously computed entirely. So if Your Honor is correct, to the extent that the point is that if they had recalculated her debt based on her prescription drugs, other medical expenses, the one-time payment.
So let's get beyond the specific focus on words by the board as you presented it or argued it, and go into the board looking at these documents and saying, could be debt, could be, you know, we're looking at this. We think it really is only a debt request.
Right. I think
how would we review that determination?
That it was only a debt request? Well, yes. I think you would look at what was actually presented, and that would be subject to de novo review. The underlying facts as to what was submitted and the timing of those submissions would be factual findings subject to the clearly erroneous standard. But the package that all adds up to and its legal significance would be a de novo, a question of law. If you look at the cases we cited, Your Honor, this issue is...
What about the Federal Circuit saying that the pleadings submitted by the veteran are read sympathetically and that's a factual finding?
I'm not sure how to respond to that, Your Honor. My position would be that it may be that it's a factual finding to the extent that you would give the benefit of the doubt to the veteran and you would construe what they're saying in the manner most favorably. But once those things are construed most favorably to the veteran, the total legal significance of that package would be a legal question.
Which one of the documents do you believe constitutes a request for waiver?
I would point to all three in totality, but I think the most significant statement is the one dealing with, I believe it's the last statement on page 36 of the record, where Ms. Edwards asks that her benefits be reinstated retroactively. And as I mentioned, that's consistent with a waiver. It also would be consistent with an adjustment at which the debt is readjusted to zero. Both of those would be consistent.
So what request for, you made an error in your calculation. Why would that not also be a request for waiver? Are you suggesting that every request to VA with regard to error in their calculations is also to be considered a waiver request?
No, I'm not. I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. There are times when it may just be a simple statement, one statement that says you miscalculated this amount. But here, what Ms. Edwards in her repetitive submissions, there were the three submissions, she did get at the steps or the factors in paragraph 4 of the notification letter. She got to most of those, if not all of those factors, explaining what her role was in how this debt arose, and that is through this one-time insurance payment. Why it would be inequitable to collect the debt, and that is because she has a limited income on Social Security and because she has these medication and other medical expenses. And so she is addressing the factors that they told her to address. This isn't a case where there's a form that's enclosed that says, do you wish to request a waiver? If yes, check this box. If no, check this box. There's also no form provided to the claimant that says, request for waiver, fill out the following information. So the claimant is left rather at sea here. They are guided helpfully to go to their local office and to seek help there, which is exactly what Ms. Edwards did. And when she sought help, she filled out on a standard form information that lines up with what the form is telling her to provide. Now, it is true she didn't say request for waiver, and she didn't use any synonyms. We're not disputing the board's finding on that. But whereas here you have this description of what you have to do, and what she does lines up with it, we think that's enough. And the timing-wise on this, Your Honor, this is right before the 180 days expired. Her May 4th submission is a couple weeks in advance. I'm sorry, her November, her May 4th submission is a couple weeks in advance. She has a May 18th submission that is maybe 1 or 2 days in advance of the 180-day deadline. And so the timing of it, if you look at the various actions...
What's the deadline for requesting, for arguing that they made an error in their calculation?
It's not, there's not an apparent deadline from the rights and conditions, and I'm not aware of any deadline for that. There is this 30-day deadline, which they point out in this notification, but that's only so that your benefits don't get interrupted. And in fact, that 30-day grace period there also applies to requests for waiver. And so when you get this submission, you know, 160, 170 plus days after the notification of indebtedness, I think it should raise a red flag that this person is lining it up almost exactly with the timing. The only 180 days I think that is in this notification deals with the request for waiver.
Did VA determine at any point that she was not seeking or she was seeking a reexamination of the validity of the debt?
I don't think they have addressed that issue. I'm not sure if they determined that that's what her request was.
So all they said was it was not a waiver request. They didn't say what it was.
In looking through the record, I'm not sure they even said that. I'm not sure how they addressed it. I think the first record of waiver decision from the VA comes in reference to this second, the $12,000 plus claim when she submitted, I think, August 22nd, 2001, a written request that did say, I request a waiver. And I think that was what was submitted to it may have been to the Committee on Waivers and Compromises, but then there's a VA record saying this is out of time. It's more than 180 days after both the May 2000 notification and also after what we'll talk about later, the July 3rd, 2001 notification.
But with regard to the first debt, VA really didn't take any action in determining what the significance was of the documents she submitted.
That's my belief based on my recollection of the record. I don't recall seeing anything in there of the VA taking on any action. And I think in the board's original decision in this case, which was a few years ago, the board directed the regional office to address her claims that the amount of the indebtedness should be recalculated based on prescription drugs and so forth.
Counselor, is it your position that each request for recalculation implicitly is also a request for a waiver?
I wouldn't go so far as to say each, in that in some other case it might not apply, but I think what you have to look at is you have to look at the information that is given to the claimant in this notification. I think this would be a fully different story if there were a form that said request for waiver or there's a checkbox and the claimant doesn't check that box or fill out the form that says request for waiver. But whereas here there's no form provided to the claimant, and instead the claimant is told, if you want to request a waiver, here's what you have to do. You have to submit it in writing within 180 days, and you have to address these factors. I think you have to look at whether those factors are addressed. And so if a request for recalculation also addresses these factors, and there's some indicia either from the timing of the submission or the nature where you're requesting benefits reinstated retroactively as if there's no debt, I think that those things all add up in this particular case and in a similar case to a request for waiver.
Well, I think your client, Counselor, very aptly represented herself in terms of the May 18th notice, which was exactly 180 days after the notification. And as I have it, she says, I currently have an overpayment due to pension income, period. None of my prescription medications since 97 were used to compute my pension. Attached, please find the 218416 and prescription printout. Request my pension benefits be recalculated using the attached and the amount of my overpayment be adjusted accordingly. Your assistance is greatly appreciated, etc. Now that signifies to me that she had a great deal of working knowledge concerning what she needed to do to include this form that was included in prescription printouts. Indicated that yes, she acknowledged that there was an overpayment, but she had a different means with which to adjust it and take care of it, apparently. Which seems different than checking a box that says I'd like to have a waiver if possible. So that's kind of what I'm looking at. I mean, she seemed to have a fairly good working knowledge of how the system worked and what needed to be done in order to correct the problem.
Yeah, Your Honor, I think she did go to the local office and she did receive assistance in filling out these forms and I presume somebody told her exactly what to compile paperwork-wise and what statements to make. But she does go and she does, she matches up. I mean, some of the information she provides are directly relevant to these factors that are provided in the statutorily required notice. So she is certainly requesting a recalculation of her indebtedness, but then in the submission the exact same day on May 18th, she does request that her benefits be reinstated retroactively the effective date that they were cut off. I'm sorry, that may have been May, that's the May 4th submission, Your Honor. So 2 weeks before this May 18th submission, she did request that her benefits be reinstated effective the date they were terminated.
I'd like to turn to the second debt question. Does the appellant assert that she did not actually receive a notice, or is your assertion limited to that the record does not demonstrate that a notice was sent?
Your Honor, my client does not know when she received the notice of that indebtedness. She knows she received something at some point in time because she did respond and request a waiver of that indebtedness. So at some point in time, she received something, but she doesn't know when she received the letter.
So she's not asserting that it's necessarily was not submitted early on such that her response was within 180 days of that letter.
That's right. I mean, there's ambiguity in the record, obviously, on that point, in that there's no letter that was supposedly sent to her, and we submit the computer printout that's used to date that letter to more than 180 days in advance of her submission is not enough to establish a presumption of mailing. But I can't tell you one way or another, based on talking to my client, whether the letter that she received was within the 180 days of her August 22, 2001 submission, or whether it was further in advance such that her submission would have been late.
I'd like to get a little clarification myself. In the briefing that you filed, which resulted in the JMR, the entire focus appeared to be on a response from your client that was within the time period to the June 00 letter that was lost in the office up in Minnesota.
Right.
On remand, you did not represent, your firm did not represent your client. That issue, it looks like VCAA was a primary issue presented by the representative, but the board still had a remand order. That issue doesn't seem to be discussed in the board decision, yet you also don't raise it here, and you've now shifted to this presumption of regularity. And I focus your attention to the board, which made a statement that there is no contention before the board that the notice letter was not received. Neither asserted nor contended that this notification did not occur on July 3rd of 2000, page R4.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, if that's the issue and that's the finding of the board and it wasn't argued at the board, why are you here arguing it?
Well, Your Honor, I'm trying to represent my client the best I can, and the reason I think...
Well, what happened between you and the board and the previous appeal to this court that it has shifted so much, and why should we permit that kind of shifting when there's representation involved in these cases?
Your Honor, I took over this case after it came from the board, and in spotting the legal issues, the presumption was what I focused on. In fairness to the board, the board was given our prior brief, a prior brief that somebody else did for my law firm before the case went to me. And in that prior brief, there is a footnote saying, we don't dispute that this letter was mailed on July 3rd. I think there's other indications that we're not endorsing the notion that the letter was mailed on July 3rd, but that for purposes of that argument, we didn't dispute it. Now, when the American Legion represented my client before the board, they submitted that brief to the board. So the board had that brief, and they may have looked at the brief closely, and they may have seen the footnote that said we're not disputing that. But I didn't have a role before the board. But I do think the presumption of regularity should not apply here because there is no indication that this letter was actually sent.
Well, do you even get to the presumption of regularity if you don't even have an assertion that they didn't receive it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do you even get to the presumption of regularity if there's no assertion by the appellant that they did not receive the notice?
Well,
in fact, the assertion is that we received it and responded in a timely manner, but you lost it, VA.
No, well, if the assertion is that you received it within a timely manner outside the 180 days, there's no argument against the presumption. For the argument against the presumption to apply, it has to be the case that there's no showing that the VA letter went out sometime.
But wasn't the argument on that you say the brief was submitted by the American Legion to the board, wasn't that argument that In fact, we're not disputing the letter went out. What we're saying is our client responded within the 180 days, and you guys lost it, and we're showing you that you haven't kept this document, and this document in the record, and therefore you lost her request for waiver, and she's repeated it now twice in a statement, and you should accept her statement. Wasn't that the argument?
That was the argument. That was before.
Well, then how do you change that? How do you just ignore that? Because you're the new counsel?
Well, I agree that may not be a satisfying reason, but I do submit that there's not enough evidence to show that this letter went out. If I could go back to the first, before I wrap up here, if I could go back to the first, the 2000.
Let me just clarify one thing. You are dropping the argument that she filed within 180 days of July 3rd, 2000, a request for waiver with regard to the $12,000 some odd debt, and that the Minnesota office lost it. You're dropping that argument.
Yes, we have not raised it in this appeal. If I could just address briefly on the $2,000, in the case of any ambiguity here as to whether her submissions constitute a request for waiver, the benefit of the doubt we submit has to go with the claimant on this. The VA has pointed out the VCAA doesn't have such a presumption.
Do you want to take some time?
I'm sorry?
You're out of time.
Yeah, I'll just take 30 more seconds, Your Honor.
Okay.
But case law predating the VCAA establishes that where there's ambiguity, the benefit of the doubt goes to the claimant. And we submit that in this case, where the claimant submits and addresses each of the factors in the statutory notice, that with the benefit of the doubt, that's enough to constitute a request for waiver. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Baird? Is it Ahern Baird or?
Just Baird.
Just Baird.
Rebecca Baird with Brian Ripple for Defender County. The Secretary would disagree with the appellant as to the appropriate standard of review in this case. Historically, this court and the board have only used de novo review in reviewing an appellant submission when those were jurisdiction conferring submissions. A request for a waiver is not such a document. The Secretary would contend that the appropriate standard of review then is whether the board's determination was arbitrary and capricious, an abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance with the law. This is so because what we have is an application of the law to the facts being a review of the actual document, the actual words that the appellant used, and the applicable law here is the notice of rights and obligations provided to the appellant. So what the board, actually the RO had to do was to look at the appellant submissions in May of 2000 against the notice of rights and obligations and see what she meant, which is trying to construe her intent from her May 2000 statements, which is an application of law to the facts. Looking then to those May 2000 statements.
Well, let's just go to the law then. Why isn't this just a simple fact findings by the board with regard to whether or not it constituted a waiver, and why doesn't the board have to apply a sympathetic reading of that? I know in your briefing you made the argument that this is not a claim for compensation, it's a request for waiver, but I'd like to have more explanation as to why in this veteran-friendly system a request for waiver would be treated somehow differently than other pleadings filed by an appellant.
The duty to liberally construe an appellant's submissions is derived from the duty to assist. That's from EF versus Dewinsky. As the court has held in Barger and in Luaris, the duty to assist doesn't apply. This is not a claim for benefits under Chapter 51. This is a case of an appellant who received benefits without a basis for having received them and who now seeks to have the agency forego its right to collect from her. This is not a case of an appellant seeking a claim for benefits, which means that the Secretary's duty to assist that appellant in substantiating the claim wouldn't apply. There is no claim for benefits here. So the Secretary would contend that we have no duty to assist her and we have no duty to broadly construe her documents.
Does the notice of rights and obligations include a statement that you must specifically request a waiver?
It does not. It provides, outside of actually paying the debt, it provides two paths she can take. The first is the right to dispute existence or the amount of the debt. The second is the right to ask a waiver of the debt. In looking at the appellant statement submitted in May 2000, it's pretty clear from the her first statement that she was requesting a recalculation of the debt. Appellant contends that the stronger argument is with the statement of page 36, requesting that her benefits be reinstated. I believe what's happened in this matter is the appellant's benefits were terminated in March of 2000 because she did not submit anything. So what she's asking for here is she's aware now that she has stopped getting payments and she wants them to be reinstated, which is the basis for that statement. In any event, it doesn't appear to be a statement that she won't pay the debt. It doesn't appear to be a statement that she can't pay the debt. Instead, she's saying, here is some income I didn't report earlier. Here's my amount of Social Security every month. Can you please tell me what I owe and if the overpayment still exists?
Well, the board seemed to be looking for magic words. They seem to be looking for a waiver request or synonyms to a waiver. I don't see that the notice requires such explicit language. If, let's just say that appellant's argument is accurate, that she is responding to each of the factors listed in that waiver request portion of the notice, would that be sufficient to trigger waiver review by the agency? If she never said, I seek a waiver. Sure.
The board's decision at page 5, it does say that they're not looking because they didn't notice any words denying this waiver. But farther down, they do say there's nothing in the May 2000 statement that may be construed as being synonymous with the word waiver or as being synonymous with a group of words that might indicate that she wanted a waiver. So the board, appears to me, was trying to glean her intent from the May 2000 statement.
Right, but it's not matching up the factors in the notice letter with what she submitted and whether those things match up.
It's matching up her two options that were provided in the notice.
So it does not, in fact, look to what items are suggested be submitted in the notice letter and looking to see if she met any of those. It's just strictly looking for whether she requested a waiver.
I think if the board had found in her statement that she had said this would cause a financial hardship, or if she had returned with the May 2000 statement, her financial status report, then it would bode well for her as far as it being a more equitable consideration. But in this case, there's nothing like that. There's just, she's provided some numbers of income and expenses and asked that those be considered. So I think the board was supported in its determination that there's nothing in here that looks like a request for a waiver.
Go ahead.
Ms. Barrett, let me make sure that I understand your argument relative to the duty to assist. The duty to assist, I believe I heard you say, does not pertain to talking about a waiver. Is that correct? And that's because it is a waiver, or it's because it's a spouse of a veteran making the request?
It's because it's not a claim for VA benefits. It's an application for forgiveness of a debt that's owed to the agency.
And your authority for that proposition is what?
Awareness.
Say again.
Awareness and 18-439.
That was, to be clear, that was VCAA notice, was it not?
That was discussing, I believe Barger discussed notice as well as the duty to assist.
Barger?
Barger, I'm sorry, yes, and 16-135. I would also like to point out, Your Honor, that any concern that the appellant didn't know how to request a waiver should be allayed by the fact that she did request one in August of 2001. So she knew that that was an option for her to exercise as well.
Well, couldn't she have subsequently learned of that since that was later in time, not preceding this particular action?
I'm sorry, subsequently learned of?
That she learned how to file a waiver between 2000 and 2001. Wouldn't it be more enlightening if the 2001 waiver had been filed in 1999, say? Then that would demonstrate that she knew how to file a waiver.
I'd like to go back to the duty to assist and the extent to which sympathetic reading, liberal reading, is derived from that same duty to assist. Did the Federal Circuit tie in its determination that all pleadings of veterans must be read sympathetically to the duty to assist, or did it tie it just to the uniquely pro-claimant, pro-veteran system?
I believe it did tie it into the unique VA system, but again, that system is applying to Chapter 51 benefits, which deals with claimants. This appellant is not a claimant for benefits. So that analysis, the Federal Circuit's analysis still wouldn't apply.
So following up on Judge Castle's question, this appellant is not entitled to a sympathetic reading because why?
She's not a claimant for benefits.
Not a claimant for benefits. All right. Even in light of the Ingram decision?
I'm actually relying on this court's recent decision in this panel's decision that was discussing whether a claimant who was an appellant who was a beneficiary under a veteran's life insurance policy was a claimant for benefits, and the court found that she was because the benefits involved came from Parts 3 and 4 of Title 38. This is not such a case. This claimant, excuse me, this appellant is seeking a waiver under Part 2, I believe.
I think the opinion you alluded to was a 2-1 decision, wasn't it?
Before you go on, I just want to ask another side question. If you get a notification of a deadness for $2,000, and let's say you did submit a waiver to that, and in the process of all that, you get a deadness that's now grown to $12,000, do you have to file another specific waiver request?
I don't believe you have to, no.
Could the waiver, I mean, if you owe $2,000 and it goes to $12,000, why wouldn't that be applicable to both of them? Is that because there's no sympathetic reading and we don't care, so therefore you got to submit another one?
No,
I'm being a little sarcastic on that, but go on.
If you look to the Notice of Rights and Obligations, she is informed that she has, the second note. Whenever this letter states that you have a period of time to take some action or notify us, the period of time begins to run from the date appearing on the front of this letter. So she.
Let me just go back and ask, because I think you gave me an answer, but I'm not sure. You get notification you owe $2,000, you file a waiver, no ifs, ands, or buts. It's a waiver. During that same process, you get notification that you owe $12,000. Do you have to file another waiver? I think you said no before, and I just want to make sure you understood my question and where you're at.
I suppose that would depend on when the waiver decision was rendered.
So no waiver decision at this time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
$2,000, request for waiver, now it's $12,000.
Moving on to the notice of overpayment that was provided to the appellant in July of 2009, $12,347. It appears to me that the appellant is arguing that VA cannot prove that she received the notice, which is not a correct interpretation of the basis for the presumption of regularity. Presumption of regularity provides that when VA did something in the regular course of its actions, we can assume that it was done. Here, VA clearly provided documentation of a mailing of a July 3rd, 2000 notice. Therefore, it is presumed that that notice was provided to the appellant and mailed in the course of a regular VA action.
But then, in fairness, that documentation isn't a normally filed business document that gives indicia of a notice going out, is it? This is a post hoc, unsigned certification. So-called certification with two. Can you read the attached documents to that? Can you tell me what they say?
The printouts from the Carrolls.
Yeah.
Carrolls is the centralized accounts receivable online system.
Right.
These show the letters that were generated to the appellant. The series 100 and 101 letters are first notices of debt, or first demand letters.
Okay, so I'm looking at record 71. And I see a 101 on the right-hand side, 11-20-99. Correct?
Correct.
Okay, and underneath it, I see a 110, 0603-2000. So is that series 100, is that a letter also, notification?
The series, the 110 letter is no longer in use. I can't tell from this certification letter what that 110 letter was.
How about 117?
117 is a second demand letter.
And what's 101?
101 is a first demand letter as
okay.
to an active account.
So what's 130?
130 is also a first demand letter, and the three indicates, I believe, that the appellant's address was confirmed.
Well, how do you compare that to 101 again? Take me back to 101. Not to be too confused, but now you're telling me 101 is an initial letter, 130 is an initial letter. The 3 and 130 means the address was good, I think you said?
Correct, Your Honor.
And
if I may,
what does a 0 mean then in 101?
The 101 letter is a first demand letter on an active account.
Okay.
The appellant's account was suspended in March of 2000. So the subsequent July 2000 letter would have been a first demand letter as to an inactive account.
All right, so 130 is inactive account?
Correct.
And the amounts that are up in the upper left-hand corner, one of them reads 12,347. The other two read 339. I don't see any that read 2,000-something.
There's two payments of 339 were checks that were issued to the appellant in January and February 2000.
Okay, so where's the dollar amount that corresponds to number 101, letter of notification 11-20-1999?
The gentleman who works for the Debt Management Center said that the date of the demand letters was November 20th, 1999, as to the first debt amount, $2,366, second.
No, I know that, but what in the computer, I mean, if I follow what you're saying, 130 ties into 12347 sent on 7-03-2000, then it seems to me that 101, dated 11-20-1999, should also tie into some amount, but it doesn't. Does it on the next sheet? No, it doesn't on the next sheet either.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm following the question. There was no amount provided with the 101 letter issued on November 20th. There's no amount set out there. There's also no amount set out on the July 3rd, 2000 letter. What you see to the left that includes 339 and 12347 are, they appear to be balances of the appellant's account and transactions that have occurred on her account. I'm happy to get further information for the court if you need clarification on this, but it's the Secretary's position that the appellant has not rebutted the presumption of regularity. Therefore, this certification letter...
Well, is there anything in the record from a business filing standpoint that gives indicia to the fact that something was mailed? Miley had a claimant returned a document that would have been mailed with the actual notice. Butler had a document in the record that had an annotation at the bottom that the notice was sent. What do we have here other than a statement from somebody saying it was sent, not even the person who sent it?
Well, we have a printout, which is what the court relied on in the case of Warfield.
Sent to her, rather she identified this letter as the third letter missing from the files maintained by VA to demonstrate that the VA files maintenance is not reliable. So, my question, I guess, is whether or not that's that whole issue is properly before the court or not. That's been litigated one time. But do you have an opinion on that?
previously, that it was not before the board, and the board didn't get into this matter because it was presumed that the appellant received the July 2000 notice. The court certainly has discretion to entertain this argument because the underlying issue is still the, whether a request for a waiver was submitted. So I believe it's at the court's discretion if you want to entertain that argument. And if so, the secretary is prepared to demonstrate why we believe the record is clear that the appellant did receive the July 2000 notice.
Now, if I can just confirm something you said. You said that you don't think that we even reach the presumption of regularity. Is that because he hasn't asserted that the notice wasn't sent, or what is your basis for that?
I'm a little unclear. From the brief, I thought the allegation was that VA can't prove that the appellant received the letter, which is not sufficient to invoke the presumption of regularity. What we need is an assertion that I never got this notice, and I haven't seen that. So certainly we may not even need to go down the path of the presumption of regularity. If we do, she certainly hasn't submitted clear evidence to the contrary that the mailing didn't occur, given that the first brief was unclear as to that issue and her August 2001 waiver request that refers to $14,000 of debt, which would indicate she somehow got notice of the second debt in the amount of $12,000 in addition to the first debt.
I got one. The claimant stated that she submitted some waiver documents to, if I'm not mistaken, St. Paul, Minnesota. Is there anything in the record to indicate that a request was sent to St. Paul, Minnesota? I'm sorry, what page?
The record at 39.
Okay.
Was sent to the debt management center. You can tell by the facts under the top.
Okay, so this is her statement in support of claim that was sent to the debt management center.
Correct. And I'd also like to clarify, if I may, Your Honor, it does not appear that the appellant sought assistance from the regional office in filing her 2000 statements. You'll note that the Notice of Rights and Obligations says a VA service representative at your nearest VA regional office will assist you. She has never said that she went to the regional office to seek assistance in filing these documents. In fact, if you look at the cover memorandum on page 28, although they were submitted to the regional office in St. Petersburg, they came from Hillsborough County, Florida, which would indicate that she most likely sought the Florida Department of Veterans Affairs assistance. Filing these documents. And that's also consistent with her statement in her previous brief at 140, saying that she believed a VA representative visited her town every Thursday. That's not something VA does. That's something a VSO or a state Department of Veterans Affairs would do. And that appears to be the case here, that they assisted her in May of 2000.
Did VA ever treat her May 2000 submissions as a request to review the validity of the debt?
Yes, Your Honor. In conclusion, it's the Secretary's position that the appellant has not filed requests for waivers of the indebtedness that she was notified of in November of 1999. Further, the Secretary contends that if we need to reach the issue of the presumption of regularity, it certainly is appropriate here. It does appear that the appellant received the July 2000 notice, and she did not file a timely request for waiver of the second debt amount of $12,247.
Thank you very much. Mr. McCarter, you have something around 9 minutes and 30 seconds, I think, but I'm going to defer to our clerk. 9 minutes and 30 seconds.
Sounds okay. So 3 seconds over on my 30 seconds. I shouldn't use it all. Just want to clarify a small number of points here. Luaris and Barger both appear to deal with the BCAA, so when they talk about the difference between BCAA addressed. And the case law before the BCAA across the board suggests that veterans or their spouses, whether acting as claimants or somebody seeking relief from debt so that they can get their benefits back, are entitled to the benefit of the doubt, and there's a duty to assist them, and there's the paternalistic system applies there.
Counselor, not to interrupt in your short time, but didn't Congress basically short-circuit that precedential finding of this court by enacting the BCAA notice, and Congress addressed this issue, and that's now the law?
I wouldn't view Congress's enactment of the BCAA as trying to trump the traditional system. I think it was just a very narrow enactment that applied to a particular chapter, chapter 51, I think, of the code. I don't think it was meant to trump it across the board and to, in effect, repeal the longstanding precedents of this court, the U.S. Supreme Court, the Federal Circuit, numerous courts of appeals. On the issue of the standard of review.
But just to follow up on that, you don't have any specific case that says that a waiver request is entitled to sympathetic reading?
I do not, no. On the standard of review, one issue here is what the board did in evaluating her and analyzing Ms. Edwards' May 2000 submissions. The board appeared to look just to see whether there were these words, waiver or synonyms. And while the board construed nothing in her submissions to be a request for waiver, there's no indication that the board actually looked at the statutorily required notice and evaluated the factors listed in there as to what the claimant has to comply with in order to request a waiver. So there's nothing to defer to. There's no board findings, for instance, whether the May 2000 claim was submitted within 180 days, although it obviously was, or whether it was in writing, although it was obviously was, or whether Ms. Edwards provided the types of explanation about financial hardship and reasons and responsibility for the overpayment. The board didn't get into those issues at all, so there's no findings on those factors, which we submit those factors are dispositive of a request for waiver. The board made no findings on that. And lastly, Judge Castle, you asked counsel for the secretary about whether one request for waiver would cover a subsequent indebtedness as well. And I'll note factually that these two amounts are tied together because the second amount arose when Ms. Edwards disclosed her Social Security income as part of her May submissions. She used that to explain financial hardship that she has this limited income.
So you're suggesting if we find that you've effectively waived or didn't properly raise the issue of the notice being sent, or we find that you had notice, if that issue is resolved against you, you're suggesting that the May submissions, because of the timing in which they were submitted, could constitute a waiver request with regard to the $12,000 also?
Yes, and that would work here because the two amounts are tied together. She was notified of the $2,000. She disclosed her Social Security income. And looking at the record, it appears that that's what gave rise to the $12,000 because the VA said, we didn't know you were getting Social Security income, and now that we know that, we see we've been overpaying you even more than we suspected, and so they came out with the $12,000 after that. So I think the two amounts of the debt are tied together in that manner, that her submissions in response to the first debt are what led to the $12,000 being imposed. That's all I had, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case will be submitted, and we will come around and greet counsel.